This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If the story about 8chan is a tale of bad actors with worse intentions, this next piece is the mirror opposite. It emerged a few months back when Radiolab reporter Molly Webster was searching for stories and, being from Ohio, naturally checked out the website cleveland.com. There she found a piece about the site's own experiment in applying what's known as, quote, the right to be forgotten. Using a complex and evolving set of criteria, Cleveland.com was trying to determine who has the right to have stories about them deleted so that they don't come up in internet searches in perpetuity. Intrigued, Molly called up Chris Quinn, whose byline had been on the story. Quinn had started out at the Cleveland Plain Dealer as a reporter, and then became an editor, and then in 2013, the head of an entirely new newsroom. Molly takes it from here.
He basically became the editor-in-chief of their online paper, Cleveland.com.
What we really were trying to do was figure out what kind of content does the digital audience want.
The audience was different. The format was different. The speed at which they had to put up stories was different. But there was one part of the online process that stuck out to him, and it had to do with time and memory.
Yeah, I think it was in 2014 when I first wrote about it.
Back in the day, if you did something stupid, got arrested, and ended up in the paper, people would read it in the morning, and then they'd throw it out.
And it drops out of sight. I mean, there's some newspapers that kept indexes that would be at the library.
And if someone really wanted to find it, they'd probably have to spend hours or days just scrolling through microfiche slides to discover that thing about you from your past. But now that everything is online, it's there.
Right up front, forever.
So as Cleveland.com started putting up all these stories about people driving drunk or vandalizing property or streaking across the football field, Chris started getting these emails.
Requests from people to take down stories about them.
I made a big mistake, owed up to it, and paid for it.
The situation has had a horrific effect on myself and my entire family.
Because they're embarrassed or it hurts their ability to get jobs.
These stories have come up in every job interview I've had in the last 5 years.
We were crushing them psychologically.
I'm just in a corner and don't know what to do.
It didn't feel good. But there was a long-standing feeling that we're the first version of history and that these archives are sacrosanct and you would never change them. Every month, I'd get more of these requests from somebody saying, your story is wrecking my life, imploring you to help them overcome a mistake.
So Chris made an announcement. This was the column that I read, and it said something like, you know, if you've had an article written about you, and it was by us, and you want it taken down or your name deleted or something, send us an email and we'll consider it. And I just thought, who has a right to be forgotten? And for reasons I don't entirely understand, he just said, why don't you just come see for yourself?
We talk it out. Just acknowledging this continues to be very much an experiment.
So that brings me into the room.
Hey, I'm Molly Webster.
They meet about once a month. When I visited, there were seven people in the room. There was the special projects manager, the social media editor, the public advocacy manager, a crimes editor, a former rock critic who is now the head of the culture desk, and a sports editor.
You're
David.
Okay. We all sit around a long table.
We're not going to name the people as we talk about them. We'll just use the numbers for the cases.
Well, yeah. And everyone has in front of them this document that's about 50 pages. It has 12 different cases outlined, and each case has got the articles attached to it, the statement of the person about what they want removed, is it a name or a mugshot, and a personal plea for why they want it taken down.
Are we ready to start?
Yes.
All right, so this is an attorney that did plea to a misdemeanor and did have it expunged. I mean, this would seem to me to be a no-brainer.
He pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice.
A misdemeanor charge of obstruction of justice.
Quick note, for a morass of legal and ethical reasons, we are going to try to keep all the people we talk about anonymous, so you're going to hear a number of bleeps.
You have no context, you don't know what, and he's had the record expunged.
He pleaded guilty to something.
Yeah, but he's saying... You know,
they started getting in these arguments about how much value an article had and whether or not it was serving a public good.
We need to put names because it's part of the public record.
This is Kelly McBride. She's an ethicist at the Poynter Institute.
I did have this experience where my kid was on a soccer team and there was this coach who seemed really questionable to me in the way that he acted around the kids. And sure enough, on the mugshot site in my local hometown, this guy showed up for domestic violence.
Ooh.
So I went to the athletic director and I was like, hey, this guy can't be working for us. And that's the use that journalists point to. You should be able to find out the bad information about somebody because you might be considering employing this person around your children.
Or employing them at all. Is this thing the lawyer did bad enough that all of us need to know about it?
If I'm one of his customers, I would probably want to know that. But he's still licensed to practice law, right? The bar here, I mean, they're pretty thorough about deciding whether somebody is fit to practice law.
You can hear them putting a lot of weight on whether or not a court has sealed or expunged a record.
The court said, yes, you've done your time. You can have it sealed. We would need a very strong argument here not to do that. You want to make your argument stronger, Laura?
All right, I mean, no, I guess.
In the end, they decided that this lawyer had the right to be forgotten, and so they just sort of like vanished his name from the article. And that was one of the simpler ones. Like, after that, things definitely got tougher because some of the cases were so complicated, like someone who killed somebody, and then it was labeled self-defense. That's still killing somebody. Does that person have the right to be forgotten? And then one of the hardest cases...
All right, on the fourth one, he did have it expunged.
Was actually a cop. His record was sealed.
But it is a police officer.
Over the course of a few years, he lied on his timesheet and walked away with thousands of dollars.
We've said on the front end of this that sex crimes, violence crimes, and corruption... were much less likely to do this. So would you view this as corruption or more as a theft in office kind of thing?
The cop said basically, look, I've been on the force for many years. This was just one mistake.
This was not some elected official. This was not use of force. I mean, this guy was skimming overtime. But when the firefighters were having time stuff too, I mean, that was a big problem. But this is one guy doing one thing. I'm so back and forth on this one.
He didn't abuse his authority as an officer. I mean, this is like any other theft.
Yeah, but I hold him to a higher standard for being a cop.
You could see people's just like opinion shift.
This was not a momentary lapse in judgment. This went on for like years.
And I'm with Mark. The public trust issue here, you know, this isn't some water department guy skimming copper off the job site. Like, this is a police officer stealing overtime over the course of years.
I don't know. I first read this and I was like, yes, I think we should let him be forgotten. But now I'm kind of on the other side. He's not a public threat, but because he is in a public position, he should be held to a higher standard.
Wait, get back to our central question. Is the value of having his name there greater than the pain it's causing him for being there?
Again and again, Chris just steered the conversation back to that question. But how do you know what information will be valuable in the future?
I mean, what stops him from going to get a job? If he gets it sealed and this story goes away, other offices might not be...
I wonder if he lost his certifications. We should look that up. Because if I mean, we're talking about another Tamir Rice case.
That's 12-year-old Tamir Rice waving a...
Hovering over the conversation was what happened to Tamir Rice.
12-year-old Tamir Rice...
holding a toy gun.
So in 2014, in Cleveland, police officers shot and killed Tamir Rice after they saw him holding a toy gun.
The two policemen said that Rice was warned three times to show his hands, but no bystander heard that or any warning before the shots.
I did not know this, but the cop who shot and killed Tamir Rice, before he worked in Cleveland, he worked at another police department where he was deemed unfit to serve. And then when the Cleveland Police Department was hiring him, they didn't dig into his records, and then the other police department didn't, like, offer the records. And since it had never been a news story that was Googleable, like, no one knew about it, so he was hired.
If all records of this disappear and he applies to be a cop again, it would be basically our fault that he's able to do bad things.
And so, in this case, one of the thoughts in the room is,
what if one of these people in a future year does something horrendous, right? Wouldn't you want to know about their past transgressions?
I actually talked about this with Chris in one of our interviews.
I mean, wouldn't that make those past transgressions relevant again?
And he told me that when they do decide to delete someone...
we're keeping a spreadsheet of the names that we've taken out.
Wow, that feels like a crazy powerful spreadsheet.
Yeah, I know.
Is it in a vault or something?
Like I keep saying, this is an experiment. And we're not there yet.
With Timesheet Cop Guy, once Tamir Rice walked into the room, you could kind of feel the energy shift to the non-deletion side. So they just wrapped it up, decided not to delete him, and then it was like, on to the next case.
Newsrooms are tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to deal with this.
That's Poynter ethicist Kelly McBride again.
Because there are thousands and thousands of people who did one stupid thing, and that is the thing that the internet remembers them for.
It is a huge conversation happening now because of something that's like bubbling up in Europe. In Spain, this guy, Mario, in 1998, he had basically gone into bankruptcy, at which point the local newspaper published an announcement about it. And then 10 years go by. Mario cleaned up, got his money back, got his life back on course. And so he reaches out to the newspaper and he was like, hey, I've cleaned up my life. Can you take this bulletin down so it doesn't show up on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
And the newspaper says no. And then he goes to Google and he says, hey, can you delist this from your search engines? And they say no. And so long story short, he actually takes Google to court. Gets all the way up to the European Union Court, which is like the Supreme Court of the European Union. And in 2014, the judges make a decision that if something is out of date, irrelevant, or not accurate, a person can request a search engine to take it down. A new right is established. This is when you start to hear the phrase right to be forgotten.
The unfortunate element of human remembering is that because our brain forgets automatically, we never had to deal with deliberate forgetting.
This is Victor.
Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, professor of internet governance, Oxford University. We can't deliberately forget. If I tell you, please forget that my second name is Michael, you will remember that. And so the problem is we don't know how to disregard memories of our past. We don't know how to forgive if we remember. And so as we become a remembering society, we become an unforgiving society.
So he is a strong proponent of policies that help us forget, even just a little bit.
I'm not in favor of annihilating memories. I'm in favor of putting them in the shoebox and stashing them in the attic. So that if you really want to make the effort to go up there, you can take them down, pour yourself a glass of wine and go through them. Mm. But you don't stumble over them every day.
All right, this is a good one. It's a college kid who got involved in...
So one of the cases that Chris and the other editors talked about while I was there was this college student who got involved in a drug operation.
It is college kid doing something very, very stupid. But, I mean, it's going to dog him for the rest of his life if it stays on our site. Everybody knows about it. Yeah, but this is a college kid doing something really bad. I mean, he was enabling people to do drugs. Years later, he's trying to get on with his life.
So the first thought you hear in the room is just, oh my God, we were all idiots in college. We should take these articles down.
I didn't have an issue with this one, but if somebody does, speak up. I mean,
but then on the other side,
there is something to me that's different between and, you know, selling pot on the side when you're in college or something and getting caught for it.
He is getting it expunged. I mean, the other thing we could do is say, when your expungement's complete, let us know and we'll take it down. But it's years later. He was in college. He was 25. He wasn't like he was 18.
So remove the fact that this is a clean-cut kid who was going to a private college. Move this scenario to the same age, the same race, but not in college and in some rural community.
And at this point, questions of race and class come into the room. All the editors are white. Most went to college themselves. Is that biasing them in some way?
Would our willingness to forgive this kid be different if the social economic issue changes here?
This isn't about forgiveness. It's about the idea that on our site, because we're so big, when you search for somebody, this is the first thing you find. And we haven't set any kind of economic strata for this. We haven't set a geographic strata. We're considering each case as it comes in. Does this kid deserve to have his name removed?
As you heard, Chris reacted pretty abruptly to the word forgiveness.
I think it's almost presumptuous for me to think that I can forgive these people.
But in a sense, you've taken on, if we acknowledge these people and offer them respite, we'll help the rest of the world do that too. That to me sounds like forgiveness.
I don't feel like we're forgiving the seven people who asked for this relief. I feel like we're enabling them to carry on with their lives without the baggage of the mistakes they made, because society is very judgmental. I think what we can do is kind of revert back to the way things worked before the internet.
Well, if we think the answer to this is to unpublish everything that somehow we collectively think ought to be unpublished, that is a pipe dream.
I ran Chris's thought by Deborah Dwyer, who is a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
School of Media and Journalism.
She has been studying journalists, how they're approaching takedown requests in this whole, like, right to be forgotten issue. And basically what she told me is, you can only delete so much.
We're never going to be able to eradicate our past. That ship has sailed. But organizations I talked to said they were considering not covering arrests or court cases, actual trials, unless they could see them through their completion. There's never going to be a perfect way to clean up everyone's past. We've got to learn to live with it. And if we can decide maybe that we ought to address it with a little bit of compassion, that gives me hope.
We're not doing that one. I'm looking for one of the simple ones, just the delete.
Yeah, for a delete.
Here's one.
Okay. So this is just deleting like a two-sentence paragraph maybe, or one-sentence paragraph that just says his name, this guy's name.
So I had a note at the top.
This story was updated to remove someone's name in accordance with the Cleveland.com right to be forgotten policy.
And hit save. And it's gone.
Molly Webster reported this piece for Radiolab. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leia Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.